Welcome to Mindvine, a mental health podcast for everyone. Since our first episode in 2016, we have been sharing stories of recovery, engaging with experts, and tackling the stigma associated with mental illness. The Mindvine podcast is produced by Ontario Shores Center for Mental Health Sciences and is available on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to the Mindvine podcast. I'm your host, Daryl Mathers, and today we're talking mental health, but in a different way than maybe you're accustomed to. On Ontario Shores, we have a forensic mental health program, and forensic mental health is maybe a bit of a mystery to some people, and especially what we do and how we treat people in the forensic mental health system. So today we're going to chat a little bit about what that is, how we deal with forensic mental health on Ontario Shores, and we have two special guests. So first, I'd like to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Coleman, forensic psychiatrist here on Ontario Shores. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Kathy Divestein, administrative director for our forensic program. So thank you for being here as well. This is kind of like a soapbox for me when we talk about mental health and the mental health system, because there's been a lot of progress made in terms of dealing with mild to moderate anxiety and depression. We see Bailouts Talk. We see people revealing their stories regarding their recovery journeys. But when it comes to forensic mental health, it's still very much, I used the word mystery earlier, but a lot more education that needs to be done around what it is and the people behind the scenes. And maybe I'll start with you, Dr. Coleman. Look, when we say like forensic mental health, we use that word forensic. We use mental health system. Like, what does that mean to somebody who may not be familiar with that term?
So I think that's a great first question, because I get asked that a lot of times, and there's various unusual ideas about what forensic mental health is. And really, forensic mental health is the juncture where someone with a mental health issue or mental health needs comes into contact with the criminal justice system. So it's just the coming together of those two things. So it could be someone who it's their first experience with the criminal justice system, and they have a mental health issue, maybe a substance use issue or addiction, and then they might go through some diversion, right? So some support in the community. But then if the charge is more serious and they're determined to have potentially a mental health issue, they might come for assessment. And then we have people who stay with us in our program who maybe have been found that they did something, a crime, but they're found not criminally responsible, which means they had a mental disorder and they weren't responsible for what they did. So they come to us, and then we engage them in a program of rehabilitation so that we can reduce that risk and help them move back into the community.
So just to follow up on that piece, so not criminally responsible, NCR, something that maybe people are familiar with. And unfortunately, sometimes people who are found on NCR may be involved in something that has media attention. Whether it's a violent incident or something that creates headlines, and people see that, and I wouldn't say everybody, but some people look at that and they're really like, well, all you have to do is say that you have a mental health issue and you don't have to serve the time or pay for the crime. And I know that it's far more complex than that. So for somebody to be found not criminally responsible, like what type of work has to be done in order to determine that somebody is in fact not criminally responsible?
So the first thing is someone has to raise it at court as an issue. And that could be a defense counsel for a client. It could be a crown attorney, looking at the facts and considering, is this an issue? Or it could even be the judge or the court. So anybody can raise it, and then there needs to be an assessment. And then that's when someone might come to our organization, for instance, in our forensic service, for an assessment of criminal responsibility. They would come to us for a period of up to 60 days. We would, be observing that person 24/7. We'd have a full interdisciplinary team assessing that person to first determine if there's a major mental illness. And then the second thing is, that major mental illness, somehow did it impact that person so that they were not criminally responsible for what they did? So you can't just say, oh, I was depressed, or oh, I was unwell, and get off, per se. We do an assessment to ensure there is a major mental illness. And then, so that's the first kind of branch. You have to have a mental disorder. And then it also has to have impacted what you did. So there's a lot of people who may suffer from mental disorders, but they know exactly what they're doing. So it has this kind of like a two-pronged approach. And then that goes, that recommendation goes back to the court, and then the court decides. So we don't decide, the court decides.
And it's a very arduous process. And correct me if I'm wrong, but people who tend to be found not criminally responsible, this is, there tends to be a pattern leading up to that event. Some of them, not everybody, but some are dealing with homelessness. Some are dealing with, you know, the disorder has left them in a state where they're quite unwell. So it, it could be more than just what happened on that day at that time with their illness. It could have been, you know, a series of life events leading up to that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's really interesting. A lot of the people that come to us through the criminal justice system, it's their first episode of illness. So they may have been, you know, the family or themselves noticed something wasn't quite right, but they're bumbling along, maybe not functioning well. Maybe they're engaging in substance use. Maybe that's a form of self-medication. You know, they're maybe not identified by, you know, other services at that time, but they become so unwell that something happens, unfortunate, and then they get picked up through the criminal justice system. So I think it's really interesting that we can have, and I think a lot of people don't know this, we can have a significant impact on that person's then trajectory beyond our service. Because if we catch them early after a first episode, we can create a wraparound care for that individual in a recovery way so that they can move through our system and then maintain wellness and then never reoffend. So that's, you know, a good news story, if you want to think about it that way. Then there's other individuals who, unfortunately, yeah, will have several episodes of illness and they just fall through the cracks and they get worse and worse. And then there's social determinants, things like substance use, housing, and the stresses get so much that something happens, you know, and some of the people that come to us, it might be something like stealing, you know, robbery, because they're in unfortunate circumstances and just all those stresses impact them. And that's how that they come to us. And then that's, you know, really unfortunate. But we, again, try to create a program where we can help rehabilitate that person and create stability to their life so that they have housing and they have follow-up and they have supports.
And the people that, like, just to follow up on your comment, like people that enter the system aren't necessarily all involved in violent crimes. It could be any number of incidences with the law that reveal that they're in need of that type of help. So when we're talking about you know, the person and the illness, when they enter the mental health system, that's can be where we come in as at Ontario Shores. So how does, you know, the forensic program at Ontario Shores work within the system that would work with the individuals who are coming you know, by way of NCR or an assessment or whatever their mental health need would be?
Okay, so when, as Elizabeth has said, when someone has committed a crime and they're looking for an assessment, we do have a forensic assessment unit where our psychiatrist and our psychologist and our multidisciplinary team will then do the assessment. So if someone were to be found not criminally responsible, then there would be then an order of which hospital somebody would be staying at. So prior to that, there would be, they would have to go to the Ontario Review Board and a disposition would then be created where and that would state which hospital that that individual would be to reside at. And within that, they would then look at what level of security, whether someone could have passes on the hospital grounds or they could live in the community or what level of privileges that the person might have. And they're and instructing the hospitals then to provide treatment and rehabilitation for the patient. The patient would then begin their way through the forensic system here in Ontario Shores. And we have two levels. We have a secure setting and then we have a general secure setting. So depending on what the disposition states from the Ontario Review Board, it would be where that individual would start. We have two secure units in addition to an assessment unit, and then we have three general secure units. And those patients would have little bit more ready to be reintegrated back into the community.
And I think, you know, one people may not understand is you mentioned privileges and the different aspects of rehabilitation. It becomes about the person's health and yes. wellness at that point, not about punishment or debt to society or any of those things that we associate with the criminal justice system, right? I think that's what people maybe have a tough time separating is once somebody is found not criminally responsible and enters the forensic system, the criminal justice system, as we know it, no longer plays a role. We have the Ontario Review Board. It's about, but it becomes for us about once that person enters the system, it's about getting them healthy mm-hmm. and back into the community. Is that correct? And for our people, that can be, you know, as unique as any individual, that path. So what are some of the maybe, you know, challenges isn't the right word, but when somebody enters the system, you know, what are we providing them? What are we looking, you know, from them in order to get them back into the community? Either one of you or both can tackle that one.
So it's multifactorial, yeah. and I think we can probably speak to different aspects of that, but I would say that the first thing is to do a fulsome assessment to come up with an appropriate diagnosis or diagnoses for that individual. And then that, together with what issues and needs they have, would set up a treatment plan for them to address all those needs. So Kathy mentioned the Ontario Review Board, and their disposition is always kind of the least onerous but most appropriate to address the needs of that client for their rehabilitation, but also then to protect the public. So it's a balancing act. And then they rely on the hospital to build a rehabilitation program within that. So we have an opportunity to do a variety of things. So we're going to address, you know, diagnoses. So if someone has schizophrenia, we're going to address treatment, and that would be medication, psychotherapies, you know, vocational and occupational rehabilitation. There's that. We have also other members of the team to do interventions. If there's a substance use disorder, is there substance use treatment? And then we have a whole rehabilitation pathway where we expect individuals to engage and build up the skills and the knowledge and the insight to be able to manage more safely in the community. And then we're really lucky in Ontario Shores, and I'll let Kathy speak to it because she knows a lot more about it. But we have a treatment mall in our forensic program, and that is one of the setups that we have to address a lot of the rehabilitation needs for our clients. And I think our clients are very lucky to have that grouping of treatments.
Yeah. So thank you for that. So yes, as soon as someone becomes a NCR patient or not criminally responsible, we then have a comprehensive plan of care where we have everybody that comes to the table, and we look and determine what the clinical pathway is for this patient. I mean, the patient is included as well, so it's a collaborative approach. And through that, the patient would then begin their journey and through the forensic system, through the treatment mall. So we have various treatment modalities, cognitive behavior therapy, illness management, recovery. There's also some groups provided with. We have a peer support program as well, where our patients can go and they connect with our peers, peer support. We have multiple groups. Concurrent disorders is another one that's something that we have. So all of our treatment programs are all evidence-based, and the goal is to help someone reintegrate back into the community and to help them move forward throughout the forensic system. So it's a fantastic program, and we've had many successes of people going through the program. And the programs are run by our clinical staff, and some of them are even co-led by patients as well. So it's quite fantastic to see. So
I think one of the things that people have trouble understanding is the amount of work that's involved on the patient side, right? So from what I understand, you know, a patient who's willing to engage in their treatment and be an active participant in recovery is going to have access to, you know, something like privileges and visits in the community and different things like that. But it is like, you know, these people are not getting off easy by coming here because, like I think you mentioned, like for a lot of people, they're coming the system. This is the first time they're dealing with maybe a diagnosis. Typically, it's complex mental illness that we're dealing with, whether it's schizophrenia or another debilitating illness. There is a ton of work to be done on the patient end when they get here. Is that an accurate statement?
100%. It's not just you serve your time
right. And
then we open the doors and let you leave. You have to show that you are engaging in your rehabilitation, that you're making gains. And we do regular risk assessments of these individuals throughout the time that they're here, and then at least yearly they get reviewed at the Ontario Review Board to determine, you know, do they have the right disposition? Are they doing well? Has their risk decreased? Is it time to provide more privileges? Or alternatively, sometimes are things not going well and actually do we need to restrict their privileges? You know, and I think that's also a big message to the individual if they're progressing and they're engaging, that they can move forward because not only are they doing well, but their risk is reducing. And it's an opportunity for the team to engage in the client also in understanding why the rehabilitation plan is what it is, to help them to recover, but also to help reduce the risk.
Just to add on to that, Elizabeth has said that the Ontario Review Board does look at the different programs, not only the different programs that the patients have gone through throughout that last year, they also look at the level of engagement. So our clinical teams do contribute to those reporting, and so we encourage everybody to attend those programs, but then to actually get the most out of it, because again, so that they can help move through the system.
Yeah, and I mean, things like housing, employment, all those things are factors too as you get further along in the recovery journey. When individuals enter the system, obviously most of them have been through a traumatic event to get there. Is that engagement in recovery, does that take some time? Like somebody coming on to a unit, like do they need time in order to be fully engaged in their treatment, or some people, is it as unique as every individual, where some people are ready now that they've been diagnosed or now that they're in this situation are ready to move forward?
I would say it definitely varies. Some people, yes, some people are ready to, some people may respond quite quickly to medication, treatments, to therapy, and they're ready and they're engaged and want to move on. And other people, it might take a little bit longer. And it's also building that trusting relationship with the clinical teams as well, too. We don't know what the history is from some people could have a significant trauma history coming in, and now we have this clinical team that's here and living in a hospital setting. So I think it varies. Some people, do move quickly, and other people it takes more time.
I would agree with that. I think it's very variable. Some of the people I mentioned who come to us with their first episode, if they are lucky enough to respond to the first set of medication treatments that they receive, if they are willing and open to engage in therapy, they might do very well and have a really positive and quick progression. Other people may be, more treatment resistant. We need to try a series of medications before we find one that works. They may be guarded or resistant to engaging in therapy. You might need to try various approaches when you're going into rehabilitation to get them to engage. So it is incredibly variable. And so that's why it's sometimes hard for people who are outside of the system or don't understand the system to say, well, why could this person, who did this thing that they see as horrible, transition through the hospital so quickly? But it's because they did engage and they did respond and they are committed to working with the programs that are available.
Yeah, and in all likelihood, they probably spent years before that untreated, floundering, for lack of a better word, and now they finally have a diagnosis. They have care. They might have been trying to access care before, didn't know how. Like, I think you kind of took my next question, because I do definitely see people having a hard time reconciling why they're in the forensic mental health system versus like how much time they've spent in it. Where conversely, like somebody who's in the system for a more socially acceptable crime can be here much longer than somebody who maybe is in here for a more violent association, just based on their ability to receive treatment or their willingness. Is that not accurate? Like, it has nothing to do with why they're here. It's got to do with their illness and how treatable they are.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. I think that's an important message too, because people often, you know, speak the loudest of the first example we gave, where someone might do something quite violent and get through the system fairly quickly because they do well. But the converse is very true. There are unfortunate patients who are very treatment resistant, very unwell, so unwell they can't engage in a lot of the rehabilitation, and they end up here for longer than if they would have served likely just a straight sentence, you know. And I think that's important to recognize too, right? It's not an easy out, like you mentioned right at the beginning, you know. It can be sometimes much, much longer.
Yeah, because you'll see in the legal system where it actually makes more sense from a freedom perspective for the individual to plead guilty and serve their time, because they will be in and out of jail quicker than they would be in a mental health facility where they could be here for an indefinite period of time. I understand why people have a hard time understanding it, because it does take some effort to understand how the system works. The other piece that we deal with, we talked about like privileges. So mm-hmm. obviously, like the more engaged you are in your recovery, the more, the way your body's reacting to medication, the way you're engaged in your overall treatment plan is going to help you in terms of like being able to walk the grounds, being able to go down the street to get a coffee, being able to visit family, and then ultimately, released. But we do have, I should say, discharged. Release is a criminal justice term. But we do have situations where patients do go missing, right? When they're on an unauthorized leave of absence. And unfortunately, it sometimes makes the media locally and even nationally. So, obviously there's some really visceral reactions to that on social media when there's a patient missing. So maybe explain, somebody who might not be familiar, like why does a patient go missing, and how is that reflected maybe in their treatment plan or their recovery journey, these blips, if you will?
Sure, you can take it. So I think it's important to understand prior to, talking about why someone might go missing, the process that leads up to actually somebody using their privileges. So I think that sometimes is... you often hear, comments on saying, how did they let that person out and why did they do that? So I think it's important to know that there's, first of all, the disposition from the Interior Review Board would outline what the privilege, the broad area of the privileges that the patient's able to use. And there's extensive, there's a risk assessment that happens. We have a privilege review system here as well. So each time a patient has a next level of privileges, we actually have a committee, has to be approved by the psychiatrist and myself. So we have this, we put some safety measures in place as well, and patient also can put a request to then to increase their passes and move forward throughout the system. But each and every time somebody does utilize their passes, a thorough mental status assessment is done by a staff member of nursing prior to that, and a mini risk assessment as well too. So sometimes people, they've been here for a very long period of time, like we talked about that. And sometimes, somebody perhaps maybe in a state of unwellness, they're just not well at, at the time, have, I want to go visit a family member, or I just want to go do this, right? So, people go missing for various reasons. Some people are just tired of the forensic system because they've been here for a very long time. Multiple reasons could be access to things that they may not have access to here, such as substances, illicit substances. So there's multiple reasons why somebody may go. So if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, I think, when we go through this process, it's not black and white, mm-hmm. right? When we're moving someone through the privilege ladder and we're helping them to rehabilitate and move forward, it's really, I would call it therapeutic risk taking. As someone goes through and does well and meets the treatment plan that we set out with them and for them, you have to take little steps every time. And mm-hmm. so there are times when, some of the reasons Kathy have mentioned, people might impulsively change, you know, do something a bit different. We usually get it right, but sometimes we don't get it quite right. And someone might impulsively go off, you know, their substance use disorder may not be fully managed and they have a craving and they want to use, or they just decide they don't want to be here anymore and they go. Yeah. And we have to help people to rehabilitate, so we have to sometimes take those extra little risks. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes we get it wrong, but then we do the countermeasure. And I would say, you know, we're very good at reviewing that when someone comes back. And there's a whole process, mm-hmm. Of alerts that go out and people that help us to locate that individual to bring them back and manage that. Mm-hmm. But then we reevaluate the risks and our therapeutic rehabilitation plan when that happens.
And more often than not, they come back shortly after their time has expired and without incident. Mm-hmm. But they made a good point when sometimes they just don't feel like coming back. Like I think people can appreciate that. You think about how we were living during COVID. We're told what we couldn't do all the time and how frustrating that was. And even though we kind of understood why, it was still at times, you know, we were, you know, we were at our own breaking point where it's like, I'm going to do this anyways, or people were deciding whether or not to, which rules they were going to follow and different things like that. And then you put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's living here and then, you know, kind of in a restricted environment for such a long period of time and then get a little bit of their freedoms back. And yeah, it's understandable. Like some days you're, you know, like it doesn't matter if you have mental illness or not. You can have a crappy day and make a poor decision. Yeah. Right. And they're no different than the rest of us. When it comes to, like success, in terms of treating people with mental illness in the forensic system, I know here at Ontario Shores, we like to tell stories about, you know, patients who have, been in our care and have whether transitioned back into the community or in a better place and they want to advocate. The forensic population is, you know, still very like marginalized and stigmatized, and we don't have a ton of people that feel comfortable, you know, sharing their stories after they've either been discharged or at a different point in their recovery. But in terms of the ability to treat people in the forensic system and have those success stories that maybe we're not hearing about, but they do exist. Like we are able to, maybe you could shed some light in terms of that area of like the difference that we can make that we just might not hear about it.
So I think the thing to for people to recognize is that the ability to provide all aspects of a care plan and rehabilitation plan for someone who's in the forensic system, we are lucky enough to have that wraparound service. Yeah. And that individuals who come through our system get that not only because we need to manage their risk, but we want to rehabilitate them so that they never come back through our system, right? Like that's our success story. If we can get someone through our system and they never come back. Right, that's a success. And I've known many patients that I've kind of bumped into when they're coming in for outpatients or in the local coffee shop or whatnot. And, you know, I knew them when they came in through the assessment unit, and then I see how well they've done and how much they've progressed. And it really is amazing how many of our mm-hmm. patients are moving through the system. It's very few who get stuck and never move forward and can't kind of keep going. Most of our clients do really well, get their illnesses managed to a point where they're taking medication if it's appropriate. They are continuing to take that medication. They have engaged in different types of therapies. They have their substance use disorder under control, and they're out in the community and they're leading productive lives. And it's just, I think we should be shouting from the rooftops, actually, for these people, and that their stories should be heard, because I think those are all a lot of our success stories. And we were lucky enough a few years ago to have one of our forensic clients who'd gone through the system
who came back and was a peer support specialist, speak about the quality standards for mental health, saying, I had these interventions while I was in the forensic system and I did well because of them. And so it speaks to that connection of being provided with the best quality of care and the success you see. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't know about. But I hear it from families of individuals who come through our system saying, my family member, my loved one, they needed all of these things and they weren't getting them, but now they're finally getting all of these things, all the pieces of the pie. So I think that's really important to remember, and why we have those success stories. Maybe we should shout them from the rooftops a little bit more.
So just to add on to that, I can think of two people in my head right now that I know who have, I knew when they came in through the assessment and knew how unwell they were and saw that, and then how they've now reintegrated back into the community and they are looking to become peer support specialists as well. So I think it is fantastic. And to Elizabeth's point, you know, sometimes people look at the forensic system as a negative thing, and it's not, because, you know, we see people who are able to get the care and the treatment that they need. And, you know, we have such a comprehensive program and that we're able to, with multi-disciplines, and that we're able to help provide that therapy and treatment and care and help successfully reintegrate people back. So, yeah.
When we talk about the forensic system, you know, both of you have worked in the forensic system for quite some time. What's one or two things that you wish people knew about the forensic system that you suspect they don't? And what would you like people to know about?
Can I jump in? Number one, my number one thing is people with mental illness commit way less violent crime than everybody else in our population. And I really wish that was something that everybody knew, because it's always splashed in front on the front page of or social media. It's always the first thing that goes in the news, and it really is one of the smallest numbers.
Yeah, the recidivism rate is quite low.
Yes.
Think of it off the top of my head, but it is exceptionally low compared to the criminal justice system.
Yeah. So that's my one nugget.
No, that's good.
That's good. For me, I think it's maybe a better understanding for our patients that are in the forensic system, because an understanding, and I've talked to several people, just understanding there's that dual stigma, right? There's a stigma of not only having a mental illness, and then that stigma of the forensic, being a forensic patient. And, you know, patients have shared experiences of, you know, things that have happened, or they're out in the community, and just that as soon as they hear, you know, forensic patient Ontario Shores, and immediately thinks that somebody's violent. So I think just, you know, the understanding that there's a person, and just that understanding and empathy about that for them.
Yeah, just to build on that, you may be sitting next to a forensic patient and not realize it, right? It's happened many times with visitors in the hospital, and having some high profile cases over the years, and they're looking for that person, and it turns out they're right beside them. They are no different than anybody else, right? They might have been had less access earlier on, but they could, like, that could be anybody. I think that's the part when I started here a decade ago and meeting people in different parts of the hospital, it's like anybody in the forensic program could be anybody. If it's a mental illness is untreated, imagine having an untreated, you know, heart condition or untreated diabetes or, you know, untreated whatever the critical illness is, and then finally being able to receive that treatment regardless of how you got there. For a lot of them, it's a life they never thought they'd be able to have. You know, just whatever's next after here. So is there anything else about the forensic mental health system or patients that you'd like to share?
I think just to reiterate one of the comments you just kind of finished there is, when you go to a rehab unit in this hospital, if you go to a rehab unit on our civil side and a rehab unit on our forensic side, and if you didn't see the sign on the door, you wouldn't know the difference, really, because they're the same they're the same people with the same kind of illnesses, requiring the same kind of rehabilitation. And I think that's a lovely thing to remember. So really, anyone with a mental health challenge deserves the same treatment, no matter where they are, and they will all respond, hopefully, really well to the same evidence-based treatments that we provide.
Yeah, that's a good point, regardless of the path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you both. This has been great. I think, you know, it's one step in hopefully giving people the opportunity to learn more and when something happens, because it does. Like you said, earlier chats, like, this is there's no linear path to wellness, and so people are going to be curious about what we do here from time to time, and I think this is a good conversation to help educate people. So thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yes, thank you.
Make sure to like and subscribe
and turn on post notifications. Thank you for watching Mindvine Podcast.